TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Technology and Globalization. The Biotech Century Might Spell the End of Nature. Jeremy Rifkin. Within the next 5 years, a decision needs to be taken that will affect all of nature. In most other industrialized countries, the controversies are played out in the public realm. There is serious debate about altering the genetic code of human beings, animals, and plants. Legislation preventing field trials of genetically modified plants is being proposed. Farmers and students are uprooting genetically modified plants and declare GMO-free zones. The U.S., in contrast, had over 70,000 field trials of genetically modified plants in 2001 alone. In addition to the field trials, farmers are planting thousands of acres of GMO soy and corn as part of their so-called normal operation. Today's speaker, Jeremy Rifkin, says that worse even than the risk to our health is the release of these organisms into nature. Their cross-pollination with other plants may spell the end of nature as we know it. Rifkin is president of the Foundation on Economic Trends and the author of 14 books on the impact of scientific and technological changes on the economy, the workforce, society, and the environment. Among them, Beyond Beef, The End of Work, and The Biotech Century. He was recorded at Hunter College at the 2001 teach-in of the International Forum on Globalization. Jeremy Rifkin.
For the last 40 years, we've been tracking two emerging technology revolutions: computers, genes. The information sciences, the life sciences. Software, wetware. In the last 3 years, these technology revolutions have begun to fuse together to create a powerful new paradigm for what many of our corporations believe will be a new page in world history. Increasingly, our companies are using advanced computers to decipher genes, download genes, manage and exploit genes. The computer is the language for the new resources. The new resources, we're told, are genes. Genes for building materials, fiber, energy, construction, food, and pharmaceuticals. We are moving from the age of physics and chemistry, which dominated the Industrial Revolution, to genes and the proteins they code for, and the cells and the tissues and the organs and the organisms, the biotech century. Let me put this in historical context. For thousands of years, we've been using fire technologies. We're a Promethean creature. We've been burning, soldering, forging, melting, heating the inert material from the crust of this planet. We've created a lot of interesting things: steel, glass, cement, cinnabar, plastics. The apotheosis? We split the atom in this century, nuclear power and the bomb. In the 1970s, two scientists, Boyer and Cohn, Stanford, University of California, accomplished a feat in biology which some say, in quotation marks, is comparable to the fire technology revolution. They took slices of genetic material from two different organisms and recombined them. Over the years, companies and scientists said, well, Mr. Rifkin, what's the problem here? We've been manipulating nature since the dawn of the Neolithic Revolution. Isn't this just a more complicated but sophisticated and efficient way to get the job done? Let me respectfully disagree. Let me give you a couple experiments that could never have been done in classical breeding in all the years of our manipulation of nature, and we certainly haven't seen it in evolution. At the University of Pennsylvania a few years ago, scientists took a human growth hormone gene. This is a human gene. They injected it into mice embryo. The mice were born with a human gene functioning in every cell of their body. These mice grew twice as big, twice as large as any mice in history. and they pass that human genetic information to every generation of their offspring. You can't do that with classical breeding. We do see occasionally genes crossing biological boundaries with viruses and bacteria, but not on this scale. Second experiment. Scientists took the gene that emits light in a firefly. They injected that gene into the seed of a tobacco plant. The fully mature plant lights up 24 hours a day. Don't ask me why they did that. Weird science, I guess. In classical breeding, you can cross close relatives because taxonomy is anthropocentric, so you can cross a donkey and a horse and get a mule. But you cannot cross a donkey and an apple tree in classical breeding. Here we have a technology revolution that allows scientists and companies to bypass every single biological boundary in the plant-animal kingdom. That's why it's both exciting from an investment perspective and terrifying from a social, cultural, and environmental perspective. Finally, Dr. Wilmot's cloned sheep. We all missed the story here. The story wasn't Dolly. The story was Polly, the second sheep. In the investment community, that's the sheep they were interested in, because here's what Dr. Wilmot did. He took a human gene, customized it into the sheep cell, then he cloned the sheep. And what he demonstrated to the banking community is it is now possible to both customize and mass produce identical copies of a living original with the same quality controls and design principles that we used on the assembly line with chemical products in the 20th century. That's why we call this genetic engineering, not therapy, engineering. Any engineers here? We got the whole humanities group today. Here are engineering assumptions: quality controls, quantifiable standards of measurement, predictable outcomes, thermodynamic rates of efficiency, low entropy bill, and utility. Now the issue at hand: do we take these engineering standards that we applied during the Industrial Revolution with inanimate materials, do we apply them directly to the genes, the chromosomes, the cells, the tissues, the organs, the organisms, and the ecosystems? We're promised a cornucopia, new foods that will feed the world, medical advances to keep us alive forever, new sources of energy when the oil spigot runs dry. But what's never asked, will the artificial creation of cloned, chimeric, and transgenic creatures en masse mean the end of nature and the substitution of a laboratory-conceived second genesis? Will the mass release of thousands and thousands of genetically modified organisms mean spreading genetic pollution across our biosphere and irreducible damage to our environment? What are the consequences to the global economy of reducing the entire gene pool to intellectual property owned by a handful of life science companies? What are the implications in genetically programming traits into the sperm, egg, and embryo before conception or after conception, and growing up in a world where people are discriminated against based on their genotype and their genetic profile? What are the consequences in making a human baby that's by perfect design principles? Okay, let's take a look at some of the issues. First, who's going to control all this? The name of the game is patents. Now, as you know, there was a big announcement that they have mapped the human genome. They only found 30,000 or so genes, they think, and that's how many they think there is. But interesting enough, now the rush is on to locate every one of those genes and the proteins they code for, and then to secure intellectual property protection over it. If this goes unchallenged, in less than 10 years, a handful of life science companies will own the genetic blueprints to make up our species. That is unprecedented power, allowing them to dictate the terms upon which we enter the age of biology in the 21st and 22nd century. Would you like to know what Dr. Wilmot's patent includes? I was just with him a couple of weeks ago. We had an interesting debate. Dr. Wilmot received a patent from the British government. This shows you how out of control this is. He received a process patent for the process of cloning. That's his right. But he also received a product patent. Any animal cloned using his process is considered his invention. And there's an addenda, which you should all know. The British Patent Office granted Dr. Wilmot's company, and PPL, licensed to Geron in California, another patent. All cloned human embryos up to the blastocyst stage of development are now considered human inventions. Now, regardless of where we may be in this room on right to life, pro-choice, we all have a gamut of views. I would think we'd all be shocked on both sides of the spectrum that now a company can actually claim an embryo as an invention. In the last century, we fought the question of whether you can own a human being after birth, and we abolished slavery. Now the technology is available to own a human being from conception to birth. It's going to be one of the great debates of the 21st century. There's a north-south issue. It turns out that you can't create a gene de novo in the laboratory. It's an extractive industry. A lot of the genetic resources, as you know, are in the southern hemisphere. The genomic companies are bioprospecting the planet, looking for rare genes in microbes, plants, animals, and humans, indigenous populations. Then they claim them as property. The southern countries are crying biopiracy, saying these are our resources, we want compensation. The northern companies are saying, no, we add value in our R&D, we want compensation. Let me say to all of you, if we allow the great gene pool and the proteins it codes for to be enclosed as either political property owned by governments or intellectual property owned by life science companies, I guarantee you parents, your children and grandchildren will have gene wars in the 21st and 22nd century. We fought wars over metals in the mercantilist era. We fought wars over oil in the industrial era, and a lot of human beings suffered as a result. You know, when the chemists isolated the chemical elements in the periodic table during the age of chemistry, we allowed them process patents, but we certainly didn't allow them a product patent. Can you imagine saying, oh, well, you were the first scientist to isolate helium, oxygen, aluminum, tungsten, we're going to give you a patent. This is your invention. The patent laws are clear. These are discoveries of nature. It doesn't make any difference how exhaustive your search was. You can't claim a product of nature as a human invention. The genes, the cells, the chromosomes, the organs, the tissues are exactly analogous. It's a one-to-one comparison. I believe that our government has been violating its own statutes for years by extending intellectual property to the genes and the proteins they code for. Ask this for your children. Will they be well served if they grow up in a world where they think of life, genes, proteins, cells, chromosomes, organs, tissues as intellectual property? We teach our young ones, when they're very, very small, that life has intrinsic value. When they're older, we introduce them to utility value. But in a world where they grow up to think by the eyes of the law that all of life is utility, what happens to intrinsic value? Is there even a reference point for future generations to understand the concept when life's reduced to sheer intellectual property? I think we can do the right thing. We can enter this age of biology in a different way. The gene pool, the proteins that codes for, the chromosomes, the cells, the organs, the tissues, the organisms, this is a legacy. It's our collective responsibility. We should establish the gene pool as a shared commons administered by trust by every nation in the world on behalf of present and future generations, as we did with Antarctica. The genes belong to millions of years of evolution. They're not the political property of Brazil. They're not the intellectual property of giant life science companies. We should absolutely prohibit any patents of any kind on genes and the proteins they code for, and the cells and the organs and the tissues and the organism. Prohibition down the line. On the other hand, much of this resource comes from the developing world. When we put together a great treaty to maintain the gene pool as a commons, we prohibit patents on genes, but we put a global tax on all the gene products and the technologies and the goods and the therapies, and the revenue from that tax distributed only to the developing world so they can preserve their genetic heritage and so they can meaningfully move into the next century with economic and social development. That's true equity. You're going to hear a new term in the next few years, genetic pollution. Genetic pollution is very different than chemical pollution. Genetically modified organisms are alive, so they're more unpredictable when you place them in the environment. They reproduce. Chemicals don't reproduce. Genetically modified organisms mutate, they proliferate, they migrate. You cannot recall them to the laboratory. The standards are more stringent for GMOs than they ever were for chemical products. There are currently 72,000 field tests going on in the United States. There's going to be a lot of discussion today about genetic pollution. Let me just raise one issue. We have herbicide-tolerant and pest-resistant genes already injected into the code of our corn and soy and other products, other food crops. But you know what the scientists never took into consideration? Pollination. What happens when those genes flow? They always flow during pollination. You cannot stop it. You cannot put a refuge around pollination. The winds, the insects, the transmission, there's no way to have a guarantee. When your herbicide-tolerant gene and your pest-resistant gene flows off-site into an organic farm or a conventional farm and contaminates that crop, who's going to be responsible? It's already happening. When those genes for herbicide tolerance and pest resistance flow out into the natural preserve and take up in wild weeds, and the weeds then reproduce, and they're herbicide tolerant, they're pest resistant, how do we ever deal with that liability? I work with the insurance industry. I've met with the CEOs of almost every major insurance company in the last 3 years in the world. They're not insuring any of this. That's the great story here. They're giving you short-term crop damage and negligence, but they will not insure against long-term catastrophic gene pollution. Why? They say, Jeremy, we can't. There's no methodology to judge risk. We do not have a predictive ecology that's comparable to toxicology and chemistry, so we can't play the game. Catch 22. How does the government say it's regulating the release of these GMOs when the insurance industry knows there's absolutely no methodology by which to judge the risk? Finally, the health issues. When you place a genetic food into your mouth, it contains a gene that codes for a protein from sources that we've never consumed. Look, a lot of these things are going to be safe. They really are. But how do you know which ones? It may be one person in this room who has an allergenic reaction to a Chinese hamster gene. But you won't know until the damage is done, and then you may not know because the foods aren't labeled. That's why the activists are right when they say this is the most uncontrollable mass experiment on the natural world we've ever conceived. There should be a strict global moratorium, no release of any genetically modified organisms into the environment of this planet. Clear and simple. Genetic discrimination is going to loom as significantly in the young people's generation in this room as gender discrimination and ethnic and religious and racial discrimination have in the past. People are going to have their genetic profile in the next 10 years. Should your insurance company, your adoption agency, your school board, the government, your employer know your genetic profile? Genes are not all powerful. That's what we learn with the mapping of the genome. Genes are only a small part of the puzzle. The proteins are a small part of the puzzle. It's nature-nurture. It's a relationship. The discrimination comes in when you judge someone simply on a genetic predisposition. We need tough new legislation to prevent genetic discrimination. One strike, you're out. You lose your corporate charter. Long jail sentences for the principals in these companies. Anything short of that won't work. Finally, I want to talk about commercial eugenics for a moment. You cannot discuss this biotech revolution without introducing the term eugenics. We normally think Nazi Germany and social eugenics. No. This new eugenics is friendly, it's banal, it's commercial, it's market-driven. Don't you all want a healthy baby? This is what makes it even more difficult to deal with. Now, how many of you, if you had a choice in the future, would program your baby in advance of conception, honestly? Look around. How many would not? How many would not? Now I'm going to convince everyone in the room you will. To show you, we have to really think about this. Not as an entertainment exercise. You will. Hopefully you won't, but you might. Here's why. Some of you, how many have children under the ages of 5? When your children are 25, they're going to be able to walk into a medical clinic and be screened for their genetic profile and the proteins they code for. If your child were going to have a baby of their own when they grew up, and they knew they were going to pass on Huntington chorea, sickle cell anemia, childhood leukemia, wouldn't you want to eliminate that from the sperm and the egg? Or the early embryo? Doesn't every parent want the best possible future for their child? That's why this is so tough. It's not a Hollywood movie. It's not black and white. It's not about Hitler's. It's about us. Do you know any parent that doesn't want their child to have the best advantages in life if they can afford it? But the problem is it fundamentally changes the parent-child bond. That's why it's a new eugenics. The parent becomes the architect. The child becomes the ultimate shopping experience in this postmodern world. And the danger here, the real danger is something our ethicists never talk about. They never talk about. The danger is the child who isn't engineered. What about the child who isn't engineered? The parents decide for ethical reasons or financial reasons not to do it. And that child's born with a disability, and I put that in quotes because disabilities are in the eyes of the beholder. We all have disabilities. The child's born with a disability. How tolerant are the rest of us likely to be to that child in a world where we come to think of reproduction as by engineering standards and quality controls and predictable outcomes and perfectible standards of measurement? Are we likely to say that little baby is a defect in the code, an error, a mistake? What kind of parents would allow that child to be born when they could have prevented it with a simple gene change in the sperm, egg, and embryo? The real casualty here, we may lose empathy. Never talked about. Empathy is that thin, little emotional bond that keeps us connected. When we empathize with each other, Vandana, we don't do it because we think the other person's perfect. We empathize with each other because we experience our frailties, our vulnerabilities, our suffering, our effort to be a human being. But in a world where we come to think of life as perfectible by engineering standards, how empathetic are we likely to be to any child growing up that does not conform to the standards our companies and our engineers have set? If we lose empathy, we lose our humanity. It's the Faustian trade-off for the predictability of design principles and quality controls. Now, how many of you would take the lottery? How many of you would take the program? How many aren't sure? This is the big wrestling match we're going to have for the 21st century. And finally, people say to me, are you opposed to the science? Look, I would never tell a young person, don't learn about genes in school or the proteins they code for. But what I would say is remember they're just part of the puzzle of life, that it's nature-nurture, it's genotype-phenotype. And I would say this, there's a hard path and a soft pathway for this age of biology. The hard path is the path that the Monsantos and the Sellers are on. They want to reduce nature. They want to engineer it. They want to create a second genesis. They want profit and the bottom line. But there's a soft path. We could use this new science to better understand our relationship to the rest of the world, to better understand the subtleties between genetic predisposition, proteins they code for, and environmental and social triggers. We could use this new science to begin to understand how to create a more sophisticated, sustainable organic agriculture. We could use the new science to begin to look at how we can move toward prevention in our medicine rather than disease management. But the soft path, there's no gene engineering. There's no splicing. There's no recombination. There's no playing God. Instead, we become a steward and a partner, a caretaker of the kingdom. We understand our responsibility to our children's generation and all the fellow creatures we travel with in one moment on this. In all of this debate, we've given such short shrift to our fellow creatures. As my wife has always said, the mark of a society is how we treat those the most powerless and those who can't speak for themselves. It's time that we put as much attention to respecting our fellow creatures in this debate as we do concerned about our own well-being. And so, can we begin to embark on a new journey? Yes, but we need a new politics. The old politics is right and left. It's still going to be here. It's deep. It's about who controls production and distribution. It's not going to go away. But as we move into the age of biology, there's a new politics. On one extreme pole, the intrinsic value of life, microbes, plants, animals, human life, the biosphere. On the other extreme pole, those who would suggest that all of life is utility, that it can be reduced to the bottom line, that it's simply chemicals for manipulation, just codes to unravel. And increasingly in this room, we individuals, our families, our community, we will make decisions in the age of biology on where we stand on that spectrum between intrinsic value and utility value, reaffirming the principles of life versus reducing life to sheer utility and bottom line considerations. I have been heartened to see so many young people on the streets of Seattle and in Washington and in Prague, and when business leaders say to me, that's a failure, I say, no, that's a success. We're beginning to see the response to these kinds of technologies. So my hope is this. My hope is this. We begin a great Socratic dialogue, a global debate. We're at a turning point. We're probably going to announce the cloning of the first human being within months. This is perhaps the most singular change, the greatest divide in the history of our species. Will we just accept it as weird science and then accept it as a new option in the marketplace? Or will we begin to fight back, to create opposition? I believe that the genetic rights movement will be in the 21st century what the civil rights and the human rights and the gender rights and the anti-colonial liberation struggles were in the 20th century. And if in forms like this, we can begin to muster up the courage, the conviction, and the will to claim our genetic rights, to claim our legacy, to share our responsibility with our fellow creatures and future generations, then we can move into the future knowing that the age of biology may be a renaissance and not a deep period of social upheaval. The moment is here. Thank you.
That was Jeremy Rifkin, president of the Foundation on Economic Trends and the author of Beyond Beef, The End of Work, and The Biotech Century. He was recorded at the 2001 Teach-In on Technology and Globalization, organized by the International Forum on Globalization. Next week, you will hear from Kirkpatrick Sale on steamboats and their role in the conquest of Indian land. I hope you have a pen handy for more information. You can get a copy of today's program with Jeremy Rifkin that includes last week's talk by Stephanie Mills and Langdon Winner for $12. TUC Radio is listener-supported. Your tape order helps us continue our work. Our mailing address is TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. Our website is www.tucradio.org. You can order with your credit card by phone or on the web. Call us toll-free at 877-TUC-TAPE for more information on how to do this. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Mariah Glarden. Thank you for listening.